Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. We have a very lively bunch this morning. Terry, Chef Terry, the audience motivator, is very active.
I'm very enthused today because we get some live people here.
Yeah, welcome to the Hot Stove Society, where we do our show every week. You too can come and hang out with us. It's $20. Go to hotstovesociety.com. I'm Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, including Palace Kitchen, open till 1 a.m. every night for dinner. And, of course, this time of year, you want to head down to Edda's and Seatown. Sit outside at the Pike Place Market. That's really
great spot.
Super fun.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat, owner of Luc in Madison Valley, and Lule downtown Seattle at the corner of 6th and Union at the bottom of the Sheraton Grand.
We are still missing on KDO, who's moved on to bigger and better things on our Tuesday mornings, but we will move on, move forward. And Sarah Leibovitz went over to KUOW, so we're just getting left.
You know, 16 years later, we're still here.
Exactly. We have a big show today. Andy Ricker, who was on the show last week, we taped an extra segment with him because I was fascinated about the big fat rice noodles. When you go to a Thai restaurant and you get pad say u with the egg and the beef and the broccoli and the hard sear with soy sauce and the wok, that's my favorite dish. And I wanted to talk about that because it's interesting how those noodles are made.
Absolutely.
And Andy was very proficient and understanding all of that. We're going to talk Rub With Love. It's our 20th anniversary of our Rub With Love product line.
I remember when you started, that didn't seem like 20 years.
Somebody said to me the other day that they thought the name of our product was inappropriate.
What?
I said, we were rubbing with love long before it became inappropriate. They did. They wanted me to change the name. And we were talking about
They actually were serious?
Yes. Yes. Because, yes. So, anyway.
Be more French for crying out loud.
We're going to learn how to buy and cook steak. Everything from what kind of oil to use. Or you could just come to my class on the 28th of June.
Which is probably a very good class to come to.
It's going to be fun. We have six different grades of New York steak. And it's going to be up to you to decide. You know, they range everywhere from $7 a pound for select to $50 a pound for
Wagyu.
The top star Wagyu. So it's going to be interesting to try them all next to each other. I'm bringing in some wine from my cellar. We're going to try...
When is this?
We're making our own vermouth. Remember the bar chef that came on like a month ago?
Yeah.
I love that little demo that he did about making vermouth. So we're going to make, as a class, our own vermouth. And we're going to make Manhattans with scotch or bourbon whiskey or rye to see which one we like better. Because I don't think a lot of people ever try them next to each other.
Oh, there's going to be a lot of meat and a lot of booze.
It's the 28th of June.
What time is that at?
Exactly. And we're going to go toe-to-toe in our food trivia. And for the first time, we're going to invite an audience member to challenge us.
Yeah, let's see how that goes.
Because once again, yesterday or last week, I lost again. I need fresh meat. I keep getting crushed.
Tom wants someone to kick.
Terry is on a winning streak. So I keep getting crushed. Let's jump right into our Taste of the Week.
Sure.
Sure.
What do you get?
What do I got?
Yeah.
Well, speaking of rice noodles, I was down at a little dim sum place called Fulong. And it's down, I want to say, it's on the very south end of Beacon Hill, right on MLK. It's a whole kind of multi-Asian shopping mart.
Mm-hmm.
It's where I saw those chickens with the feet kind of hanging out the bottom of the bag and
you
wondering who the heck would buy these. And then Andy Ricker said, I'd buy them. And that's the perfect kind of chicken to buy for your chicken soup. But at Fulong, I keep looking for a better dim sum. I got to say, I went all the way to Hong Kong for better dim sum. And I found it to be somewhat the same as what we get in our dim sum here. So maybe I'm just...
Maybe you should make your own dim sum.
Well, maybe it doesn't come better. Maybe it's not supposed to be better.
Correct.
Because sometimes I think that. As a Western chef, I try to, should I use organic this? Or am I getting the best chicken? Well, you know, dim sum is not about the best chicken, right?
Right.
It's about small plates of love that you pass around and share and have a quick breakfast and enjoy for what it is.
And
I think I overthink it a little bit.
And I think it's also originally very classic Chinese. It's not...
Well, certainly.
You know, it's not made for... You know.
Yeah, it's made for 1,000-seat restaurant houses in Hong Kong that have... you know, five turns, and they do 5,000 covers in a day.
Is fresh and rotating, yeah, exactly. And all that stuff.
So anyway, so I think I overthink dim sum sometimes, but I'm always in search of one because after going to Yang Tsing in San Francisco, I think that there is a better version out there. So went to this Fulong, and it was very typical, very much the Nor Mai Gai, which is the glutinous rice that's wrapped in lotus leaves. The the lobak go, which is the turnip cakes with the rice flour. Uh-oh, right. I'm taking up the whole time. You know, the hagao, everything, shumai, everything was very similar. But I did have these rice noodles that Andy's going to talk about later in the show that were hot seared with kind of a sweet soy sauce. Delicious.
That sounds
really, really delicious fresh rice noodles. What was your taste of the week?
My taste of the week was me taking my mother and my brother, who are visiting from France, to Taitung. And forgetting they don't like hot, spicy food and ordering the hot, sour soup. That went like a piece of lead in a bucket of water.
Yeah.
That was like, they were like, oh my God, what are you doing? You know, I completely forgot. But that soup, by the way, that's my taste of the week because I think it's, I completely forgot how delicious that soup is.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very simple, but the flavor and the finishing is so delicious.
The heat builds, doesn't it?
The heat does build. You know, they're not too shy about it. But it's a very delicious soup, and I haven't had it in quite some time, and I thought a hot sour soup is a great taste, memory taste. It brought back memory taste in my head, and I thought, oh, that's my taste of the week. That's cool.
So sounds delicious.
Taitung, you know, of course, in Chinatown, I recommend that restaurant. And Harry Yoshimura was there when I was living.
So. Yeah, Harry is often there. So Harry Chan owns the place.
Correct.
It's the oldest Chinese restaurant in Seattle.
Right.
1935, I want to say it started.
Correct.
And Harry Yoshimura from Mutual Fish, our mutual friend,
often
has lunch there, and I run into him there myself. If I was going to Taitung, I don't know if you've all been there or not, but it's just a sweet spot. But go to the counter, sit at the counter. Oftentimes, Harry, the owner, is waiting on the counter.
Yep.
And so that's how I started hanging out there. And when you look up and you've just ordered the salt and pepper fried pork chop or the fish with the Chinese greens, when you look up and you take your first bite, and you look, oh my God, there's a picture of Tom Douglas hanging right there on the wall. Did you see my picture?
Yeah, of course. I showed it to my mom. She goes, oh, that's Tom.
Yeah, exactly. Up next, Andy Ricker from Pok Pok is going to talk rice noodles with us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We are back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. My name is Tom Douglas. Chef in the Chapeau is with me, drinking tea, having fun. We have a special guest on the line. Andy Ricker is here from Pok Pok in Portland. He's got six restaurants throughout the Portland area, and he's got a new book out called Pok Pok Noodles. Last week when we had him on the show, he talked a bit about some of the favorite recipes in the book, but I never got a chance to ask him about my favorite noodles.
Rice.
Rice
noodle?
I love the big, fat, wide rice noodles.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have them in lots of different ways. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I was just telling Terry, I love the big, fat, wide rice noodles. The pad seyu is what I get them with in Thai restaurants. I use the chung fun, which are the wide rice noodles that are kind of rolled with green onions, maybe some dried shrimp sometimes. You see them in dim sum restaurants. But I'm just a big fan of these rice noodles. Your book seems to have, I was just looking at a recipe, I can't say it, but I was looking at it. Karai Thai Kuapet. You know what I'm talking about?
With your Kuapet. Yes.
Yes. Tom always had a very, very high, a good foreign language can on this one.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for that, Chef. Anyway, let's talk rice noodles. You know, there's the Korean style that are kind of hard, sliced out of a bias from a roll, and then there's these more Chinese style that are made from ground rice that are kind of what we consider fresh noodles, even though they're just kind of rice, ground up rice. So can you talk about rice noodles for us?
Sure. So in Thailand, kwet teo basically means rice noodle or noodle. Noodles in general, but more specifically rice noodles. So kwet teo sen lek, which is small. Sen mi, which are very, very thin, like an angel hair. Senyai, which is the most common versions of Baltimore. Senyai is the one that you're talking about, also known as Haofan, I think, or Chaofan.
Yeah, exactly.
My Chinese isn't so great. But the way that they're made is really interesting. And if you get the book, we have a whole photograph sort of story in there that shows the process. So they take jasmine rice flour, and they have a mill, and they just mill it in-house. Big giant stone grinder, and they mill it with a little bit of water to create this very, very fine paste, like a slurry more. And then they add a little bit of tapioca starch to it, and that gives the noodles some snap and chewiness and flexibility. That was something I didn't realize until I went through the factory with these guys. This is one of their little secrets. There's a little bit of tapioca flour. And then they take the slurry, they load it into a hopper, and it gets fed onto a long conveyor belt that goes through a steamer in a very thin layer. And then it comes out of the steamer and it goes through a series of rollers that are oiled with vegetable oil, and it comes out in a long sheet, and then they slice it into whatever shape you want it to be. And then if you're lucky, it never gets refrigerated, because as soon as it gets refrigerated, all the oil and the starch and everything kind of seize up and it gets hard. And it's really hard to get them back into a form that's you know, texturally good after that. So if you're lucky enough to live in L.A., there's a factory or two down here, and they deliver directly to the stores in the morning, and you can grab the packet, and it's still warm.
Wow.
And that's the stuff you want. If you're up in Seattle, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure what you'll find is the refrigerated version of that also comes from the same factories down here in L.A.
We have our own. Chuchung Noodle Factory makes fresh rice noodles. And at Wajimaya,
fantastic,
which is a big market here in downtown, you can get the warm Chung Fung. They don't refrigerate it either. And they do a beautiful job. And that's probably where I fell in love with it first, was having gone through the factory with the Henry family. And, you know, they do all sorts of noodles. But the rice noodle thing I thought was fascinating. Just like you said, the thin batter onto the steamer and layering it. And it's just it's awesome.
You can also make it at home. You don't have to have a rice. You can get rice flour and tapioca flour and make a slurry, and then make a little pot with it and stretch a very fine, almost like a cheesecloth over the top, mm-hmm. And then ladle it on, and then that's how they make the rice rolls that you were talking about for dim sum before on the street.
Right.
So you can actually do it yourself if you can't get the fresh stuff. It's a little more. It's a fun experience doing it, but it's a bit of a commitment.
Yeah, making noodle from scratch is definitely a commitment.
Always. Let's talk about the noodles that are becoming so popular right now. They're not really what we perceive as noodles, but it's the rice cakes that are kind of a roll that's cut on the bias and used like a noodle. You know what I'm talking about?
I do. They don't really have a tradition of that in Thailand. They have other things that are interesting and unique, but not that particular. That's a Korean thing, right? The Korean rice cakes. Yeah. Those are delicious, too. Those are fantastic.
But they pan fry up beautifully, as do the rice noodles, so you can get them nice and crispy and lovely. And my favorite is at a Korean restaurant here in town. They do it with tomato sauce and hot dogs with those little rice cakes. Very popular.
Yes.
Other ways to use rice noodles. I mean, everyone knows about pho, which is generally a rice noodle. So any other thoughts about rice noodles?
Sure. So pho is also called fenlek in Thai. So that's the smaller rice noodle. There's also the noodles they call sen pad thai, which looks like the pho noodle, except for it's about twice as wide.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff is semi-dried, so it's still flexible. And you buy it in the refrigeration section. That's a quick soak before you cook them. Or if you're going to boil them for soup, you just drop in the boiler. The other interesting noodle that doesn't see much action here is called senmi. It's the very, very thin rice noodle, and it's really nice for delicate soups. Like if you want to do the chicken noodle soup, if you use senmi, the very, very thin version, it's quite nice. It's more delicate, and it works really well with the broth. And that you can buy. There's a Thai brand called Waiwai, W-A-I-W-A-I, and they make a very, very thin one. Those are really, they cook really, really quickly, and they just got a nice texture to them.
Would that work well in salad as well?
Yes, I believe it would. Though typically, what you see more often is you would see wunsen or glass noodle, which is, you know, again another Chinese noodle. And just a quick note here: basically, all the noodles in the Thai canon are Chinese in origin. They don't really. They're the only noodle that they have that they can kind of claim as indigenous is tunum tien, which is a fresh rice noodle. And it also, I find that whole noodle to be absolutely fascinating. And there's a whole chapter on it in the book, shows the procedure. It's a really amazing tradition. It'll take me a long time to explain what's going on, but essentially it's a fermented rice flour batter that they extrude and make this really fine rice vermicelli that's fresh. That's delicious.
Such a beautiful, intricate world.
Our guest has been Andy Ricker. He's got a new book out called Pok Pok Noodles, available in every store in America. 10-Speed Press is the publisher. Thanks for spending a few minutes with us, Andy. I appreciate it, both this week and last, right here on Cairo Radio.
Andy, thank you very much.
Coming up, how do you properly prep a fish? What cut of steak is best? We're getting into the meat of the matter here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Hey, we're back in the Seattle kitchen on Cairo Radio here. We're at the Hot Stove Society with our lively audience. We're glad you're not dead. We're glad you're lively. Terry, we're going to meet in the middle.
Okay.
And I think the idea behind
this is...
That means
between you and me, there's a barbecue or a grill or some kind of
there
stove.
There is exactly that. There's six burners and a grill in the middle of us. We are going to talk a little bit about how to prep fish, getting ready to cook... cooking it, and then how to let it rest, but both fish and steaks and roast and lamb chops and all the different things that people like to use in the summertime. And I just heard myself being off mic there for a second, so I got you there, Sean. Anyway, so let's start. Right now it's salmon season, right?
Right.
We are in the middle of Copper River salmon season.
Correct.
I have been eating it like crazy.
Yeah.
If you... don't want to spend the money on the king, buy the sockeye, buy the coho, whatever right. species you can find out there. It is a terrific fish. People always, here's my problem with what's going on with the Copper River, and I don't think it's appreciated. People always just say, oh, it's too expensive, they're gouging, they're doing all this stuff, right? And I was doing an interview with the New York Times, and they said, well, what do you feel about how expensive this Copper River is? And what have you seen? I've seen it in the store for $50, $60, $70 a pound. And certainly in our restaurants, we are charging somewhere between $50 and $75, depending on the species for the fish. It's expensive for a portion.
Right, no, of course.
But I think, you know how I feel about the whole pebble mine issue, right?
Of course, of course.
I think the Copper River is kind of the poster child. I think of it as kind of the amplifier of what we need to do to save the salmon runs around that are left,
correct,
on our planet,
well, especially
right?
in that part of the world. It's such a wild area, you know. It's still clean, it's still wild, and in order to save the last place on earth where there is that many wild salmon, we need to buy it and we need to eat it. We need to make the fishermen survive in order for them to keep fishing and to keep bringing the salmon back. So
right, and we need to give jobs to the indigenous people who live in that area,
correct.
So that they don't choose mining. Oh, toxic mining.
Correct.
Over fishing.
Correct.
So a well-managed run, all that kind of stuff. So going back to my point of Copper River has become such a phenomenon around the country, it is kind of like doing this job for us of educating people about wild salmon, about that the resource is there. So many people, they don't even think about it. They just go buy farm salmon at their grocery store.
Correct.
And they don't even think about it. So it is... I look at it, even though it's expensive, it is doing a great job for the industry, for wild fish.
Of course.
And for fishery management. So,
and it's a treat. I mean, it's just like anything else that comes once a year. It's a treat. And if you can't afford it, have your neighbor buy it for you or share the cost. or, you know, but it's definitely a treat. And it's not for, I mean, obviously not for everybody at that price, but it is definitely, if you can afford it, just buy a nice couple of
pounds. Just one time a year.
Yeah, just buy a pound and share it with someone and you know, treat yourself because it's definitely worth it.
Okay, chef. So, okay, now you're going to, let's say you're going to Metropolitan Market and you've got your choice of sockeye king. You know, sockeye, let's say it's at $25. King's at $50 a pound. There might be a coho in there at $25 or $30. What are you buying and how are you preparing it?
I'm going to buy the coho.
Okay.
Because I like that fish. And I'm going to put a whole fillet of coho.
I'm gonna, so you're buying it. You're buying it fillet. You're
I'm buying whole fillet because I can cut my own fish and not scared about that. So I buy the whole fillet and then I'm gonna put it on a sheet pan or a cookie sheet, whatever at home. I'm gonna put a little topping to it. I'm gonna do like a little olive tapenade. I do that quite a bit. And the reason I do this is because I like to cover my salmon because I'm gonna put it on the barbecue, super super hot, skin on. And I'm going to let that tapenade be right on top of the salmon. I'm going to put the fillet, two big spatula, put it down on the grill, no flame underneath. The coals are moved to the side. I use a coal Weber 22 inches, and I pull the coal on the side in those baskets, super hot, put the salmon on the grill, close the lid, and I wait about 8 to 9 minutes. It's about the temperature for a fillet about an inch and a half thick, you know, at the top, maybe 2 inches. And after 9 minutes, I take the whole thing out and I take it off the skin with the two big spatula, put on the platter. And if you're scared of doing the whole fillet, you can cut it in half and you'll have two pieces of salmon. It's easier to manage in terms of moving it. Put it on the platter. And when you're putting it on the platter, you have to remember it keeps on cooking. It's not stopping to cook right away. So when you're looking at the salmon, if it's medium rare, rare to medium rare, that's about where you want that fish to be. Because when you put on the platter, you know, remember, everything is hot, so it's going to keep cooking a little bit. By the time you sit down and eat it, it will be medium rare to medium. So it will be perfect flaking out like you want it to be. In the meantime, I leave the skin on the grill, close the lid, come back about 3 minutes later, and then remove that skin that's now crisp on both sides and use the crispy skin to be put it as a chip on top of the salmon as a garnish.
Good luck on that. That's all I got to say. Not burning that.
Oh, yeah, good. But
you said it was on a cookie sheet, though, or something.
No. I removed it from the cookie sheet.
I use the
cookie sheet to work with it. But it's definitely the skin is on the grill, and the flames are on the side. Remember that? It's super hot.
Indirect heat.
The indirect heat. So.
And what temperature are you taking the center of that fillet to?
I do about 118 to 120. And I stop at 120, take it out, because if the inside is 120 and I'm cooking the fish under the barbecue, by the time I take it out, it will be at 130 by the time I sit down and eat, and that's where I want it to be.
And the health department would suggest that they want that cooked over 145 degrees. Just
they would
a disclaimer.
They would suggest that, but I like my salmon differently.
This, to me, is an interesting time to do some salmon research. So I would say, when you go to your salmon case right now, you're going to see king possibly from the Columbia River. You're going to see king possibly from other areas of Alaska. You're going to maybe see king from Copper River. And you're also going to see multiple sockeyes, including possibly Bristol Bay frozen sockeye.
Correct.
Now's a fun time, if you're in the mood, to get a small slice of each and to then just simply bake or simply steam those and really try for yourself. It's like doing a cutting, right?
Correct.
Like if you buy five different kinds of canned tomatoes and you open them all and you taste them next to each other, that's the same way I feel about this salmon.
Right.
And this will really drive home whether or not you feel like the Copper River is three times as expensive and three times as good, or if you prefer something.
And it's the same principle as a bottle of wine. You know, you get some wine, $100 a bottle, some wine, $10 a bottle. You know, you do a testing and you go, well, I cannot taste the difference, so therefore I'm not going to buy it. I mean, it's an honest truth. We don't all have a palate that extended to the point where you can distinguish a king salmon, you know, from one place to another.
Especially if you've got a topping on it like you have. Like
exactly.
Okay, so next thing I want to talk about is in our meeting in the middle is a New York steak.
Okay.
I think it's a very popular cut. I tend not to buy filet myself. I know a lot of people love rib steaks. But to me, they come too thin. You can't get a proper sear on the outside. So an inch and a half to 2-inch thick New York steak. super hot seared on the outside and let to kind of rest. So when I'm at the butcher shop, let's say I'm now at Ballard Market, I'm at the butcher shop, and I like to go to butcher shops where there are actually people there, so they'll cut you what you want.
Piece of meat, yes.
But anyway, I'm looking at that New York steak, and I'm looking for a nice trim.
Uh-huh.
I like to buy choice or better.
Right.
If there's prime there, go for it. A nice trim, less than a quarter inch all the way around. That fat on the outside is not going to marinate into your meat, right? That's just going to go into your fire and cause soot fires.
It is one place where the fat is actually not that great to be there. Because,
not on the outside, yeah.
Right, because mm-hmm. it's actually not doing anything to your meat. It's falling at the same time as you're cooking it. It's not helping the meat to be tasting better. It's actually smarter to, if you have a fat cap on your New York, to take the fat out and render it gently in a pot where you get beef fat. And very good beef,
especially
fat.
If you're going to say cook it in a cast iron pan.
Correct.
Right.
But it's not helping your steak to have it a big fat cap on top of a New York
around
steak.
The outside. Yeah. Some people like to eat it. The other thing I want to make sure I got into this is when you're looking at this New York steak, right? The New York steak is a strip loin as is typically about 18 inches long, and you can talk to your butcher about this. On one end, it's called the nerve end, right? And it's got a little kind of bubble on the nerve end on the top of it. It's the other end is nice and perfect and symmetrical, and you cut a 1 or 2 inch steak, whatever you like there. And here's another trick. If you like a smaller steak, cut a 2-inch steak and then cut it in half and cook 2 pieces, right?
Correct.
Because then you still get the thicker steak. But you don't want to end up with a 1/2-inch or 3/4-inch steak because you can't get the right sear on the outside of it. So anyway, the nerve end, you'll see the nerve kind of dips down into the center of the loin. And those are the ones that, as a smart consumer, you want to avoid. Unless you're going to eat it well done, that nerve end is inedible in the middle of that steak.
We take
and
it out in the
your
restaurant.
Butcher doesn't know your sophistication level, but if you say no nerve end, they'll go look at you, their eyes will pop open a little bit, and they say, oh, this person knows what I'm talking about, what they're talking about, and they'll give you the better steak from the center or the sirloin end right. of that
from
strip
the tail,
loin.
Basically.
Yeah, exactly. So that's just good shopping, right? That's good.
And if you buy a big piece of that New York and you have that on it, just carve that out. And take the skin that's in there out.
Yeah, carve that stuff out you just paid $20 a pound for. Okay, up next, barbecuing on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. And we are getting down into barbecuing. We just talked about how to pick your meat and your fish out of the case. There was a question from the audience. We talked about the nerve end or the gristle that runs through the nerve end of the New York sirloin. There was a question about tail pieces on salmon. I say I always right. go for the center cut or towards the collar of the right. salmon. And, of course, some people prefer the tailpiece. To me, in wild fish, the tail is what does all the work.
Correct.
And it's the leanest part of the fish, and it's also the
most muscular. Like
yeah, most
really,
muscular, stringiest
yeah,
part of the fish.
Yeah.
So that's why I tend to avoid it when I have the option. When I'm buying a whole fish, you eat everything.
What I do in my in a restaurant, what we do is we cut the fish this far from the tail, and we use all these pieces to smoke and then to do like a rillette or to do a spread or whatever, because that's actually a more tenderized meat now.
Mm-hmm. So we are back. I'm sorry, I just jumped right into that. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
In case you're podcasting us and you're caught in the middle of our conversation, let's jump into barbecuing. You talked a little bit about it the last segment. Let's set up our grill. I was just writing a newsletter for our list for our customers and talking about different Father's Day gifts that I think my dad would never splurge on. Didn't really have the money, but I certainly would because I have one child. He had 7.
What is funny, you know, sometimes people don't splurge on things they actually need.
Where yeah, they, you know, do you really need a $2,000 grill?
Oh, no.
No,
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 not that. I was going to say like a pair of long tongs or something. And they will keep using that stupid fork they've been using for all their life, but burning their hand each time where you go to the store and you buy a $7 pair of tongs and you've got safety for the rest of your life and much easier to manage.
Exactly.
Those kind of items. That's what I was talking about. Not the 2000.
Well, if my dad was still alive,
yeah.
And, you know, when I go back, I often had to cook when I went back. I would be buying this Weber Summit charcoal grill that I own.
Oh, yeah. You talked about that.
There's a couple of reasons I like this particular grill. And like I said, it's a $2,000 grill. I know it's not for everyone. I'm just saying, for the man who has everything and needs something better, like to me, this is for the man who has, like, the Cadillac gas grill in his yard. And who doesn't realize that gas grills are for losers.
Oh!
Charcoal grills are for real men.
We're going to have a lot of gas grill in the trash Monday.
I want to get so many letters on that one. Anyway, it's a nice option. I'm kidding. It's a nice option. This particular grill, because it has a little gas starter. You know, it's got one of those little Coleman.
Right.
One quart butane or propane starters.
Too.
Yeah. Anyway, a lot of the effort in this grill, which I really like, is it's built like a green egg. It's got the big, thick sides, about 1 or 1.5 inch sides, so it's got lots of insulation, very steady heat, good damper control. It's got multiple levels, unlike most Weber grills, where it's really, I think, sort of difficult to get a great sear on your steak.
Mm-hmm.
This one, you can build the fire right up next to your grate, so you got a fabulous
also,
sear.
Also, it goes up and down?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, nice.
Not so much up and down like you're thinking, but there's two different levels.
Oh, wow, that's nice.
It also comes with a diffuser plate, which I used on my brisket last week over at the farm. So you build the fire down on the bottom level, and you put a diffuser, like this insulated steel plate over so that the heat goes into the plate, and then it doesn't have a hot spot.
Oh.
Right? So it diffuses the heat around the sides of the
more
grill.
More like an oven kind of idea.
Everything kind of gets the same kind of heat and a better heat level. I kept mine at 250 degrees for 10 straight hours.
It's funny because I did
one little extra load of charcoal and that was it.
Yeah, I did a 3-pound brisket about 3-4 days ago. And I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning to take it off the grill because I didn't want to charcoal briquettes in the morning.
Yeah.
But it was 225, but that was in the egg.
Yeah.
I have an egg, a green egg, and those things just, for some reason, keep the temperature to a T. It never, ever, I mean, you could be like varying 5 degrees.
Yeah.
Which is hard to do on normal barbecues because they leak all kind of heat, so it's very hard to do. But that egg is so seal tight that it makes, I mean, you can vary by just moving your vent gently on the bottom and, on top. You can vary the temperature within 5 degrees. It's really amazing.
So whatever barbecue you have, I think you would agree with this, is that even if you've got that little one from Australia, the Aussie grill or something, I think they're $49 at Lowe's or something. Any grill you have, you should invest in a thermometer that goes up to those high temperatures, right? Drill a hole right in the top of the grill that is the same size as the stem of the thermometer and just drop it in because you are the only one that can manage the heat in that grill. And the way to manage it is through the damper controls.
Correct.
But if you have no idea what's happening inside your grill, you're a loser.
Right.
Right?
You won't know.
You're just guessing. And then you keep opening the top because you're not sure. But I know with that stick thermometer in there, I know it's at 225. It's at 275.
Right.
I know. And 600. I don't have to keep lifting the lid.
Yeah.
Because that does a lot of things, right? Number one, you lose your heat. Number two is it adds oxygen, so maybe it creates more heat when it recovers. There's just a lot of bad things about
opening. Yeah, it's been 15 minutes, so it should be hot enough. And then you look at your thermometer and it's 300, and you're like, oh, I wanted 600. I'm going to sear a New York steak. So, you just got to be patient. But it is definitely a safety. I think for barbecue, you need the basics. Like I was saying, a long pair of tongs, you know, to be able to stay away from burning yourself on the grill so you can manage flipping things on the grill, vegetables and so on and so forth. I think a thermometer is a must. Mm-hmm. I think a cookie sheet or something to throw things in it when things go a little bit faster than you want, right next to you, right next to your barbecue is important. You should have some kind of a table or a countertop or something if your barbecue doesn't have one. And a rag to be able to clean your grill as you go, because that's very important. An old rag, then you tie it up with some twine and then a little bit of oil on it, and then you manage your grill like this so it doesn't stick and doesn't, you know, when it's hot, it's ready to go. It's perfectly clean and doesn't stick.
So let's be clear. We're talking about barbecuing, right?
Correct.
So
barbecuing
smoking is a whole nother deal.
Correct.
I like to say barbecuing is an art. Smoking is a religion.
Correct.
Because with smoking, it's low and slow. You have to have patience. You don't want to be lifting and closing the lid. You just got to trust that the smoke is doing its job.
Correct.
Right? So that's a big, important thing. Grilling, you have some techniques that we were just talking about. I think one of the other things on grilling is indirect heat.
Correct.
Right? You really don't want to take a beautiful piece of salmon and put it over a 600-degree white-hot charcoal fire, right?
Correct.
Because you're going to burn the flesh, and it's going to taste burnt.
Correct.
And it's just not a proper way to cook.
You
just do it on what we call the edge grilling, right?
Right.
You work the edge of the fire. You move all your coals to one side and then kind of work the edge of the fire to a heat level that you can control that's not burning the fish.
Correct. Yeah, you can buy those baskets. You know, they provide those half-moon-shaped baskets. Mm-hmm. From Weber or whatever, you can buy them and put them on the side, and that you still have the same amount of heat. You just don't have it as a flame. You don't want to see flame when you're grilling. That's not a good idea. Even though it looks good on TV, it's horrible in taste. So you don't want to do that. You want to have high heat but no flame.
Yeah, I think I don't know that I always agree with you on that. I think that consistent flame is a problem, but if you can move your grate around the grill and get the hot spots to even out,
right,
and get it onto your steaks. And then I just want to guess this. We only have 30 seconds, but resting.
Oh,
whether
yeah.
it's salmon or halibut or steak.
Or the chef.
Or a roast. Or the chef. You need to rest
that
your
is
meat. And proper resting is you have a little cookie sheet, and you all know what a cookie cooling rack is, right? That little wire rack. Put that on top of your cookie sheet and put your hot steak that you take off the grill on the rack. When you put it onto a plate or onto the cookie sheet directly, you capture the heat on the outside of that steak that just came off at 600 degree.
Correct.
And it sits there and steams on the bottom, right? And it continues to cook that steak until it's overcooked by the time you eat it. Rest it on a rack where airflow can get around that steak, and you'll have much better success of getting that beautiful red all the way through your meat, which is what resting does, right?
And if you're worrying about cooling off the meat, just slice it thin, fan it out on the plate, and put it on your barbecue. Close the lid for 1 minute. The meat will be hot again.
All right. Up next, it's questions from you, our trusty listeners. And if anybody in our audience wants to jump up on the mic, you are welcome to on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. Thanks for hanging with us during that long break. We appreciate it. We have another full hour to go. We're here every Saturday and Sunday. 2 hours on Saturday, 2 hours on Sunday, and sometimes even Sunday night, depending on the Cairo Radio scheduling. Still to go in this show, we're going to have some tips on desserts, even though Brittany Bartleben has taken the week off. And, of course, we're actually taking names from audience members to see who wants to challenge us today. For the first time, we've never done this before, first time in our Food for Thought,
I have
tasty
a bad feeling
trivia.
About this. I think we're going to look terrible.
I think you're right. And the way we look to begin, that's not a good place to end up.
We're going well old now.
Okay. All right. So we're going to take some questions from you, our listeners. And, of course, we offer this chance to our audience to step up to the mic. And Guy has done just that. Hello, Guy.
Hey, Tom.
What kind of questions do you have for us today?
Well, the main one I have, and this kind of relates to the steak issue. Right?
Yeah.
Is sous vide.
Yes.
Do you guys use it in your restaurants or at home? What particular things, if so, what kind of things do you use it for?
Mm-hmm.
And what would you recommend for home cooks like myself?
Well, I'll just jump in for 1 second because I started working with sous vide a million years ago. It's a French technique, and we did it on the airlines because that was a way to keep everything at the right. When I was at the Northwest Airlines chef a million years ago, we had a French sous vide company
sure.
we would buy product from. They're still in business, by the way. And
in Washington.
But now it's become a popular home technique. And I think Nathan Muirvold, our friend from Bellevue, modernist cuisine.
And the guy at the Market Steps.
Yeah.
You know, they come up with the...
But, Chef, why don't you jump into...
So sous vide is a technique of cooking, putting an item in a bag, in a plastic bag, seal tight, no air, so the air is vacuumed out, and then you cook that meat. It can be fish, it can be vegetable, it can be meat, it can be anything. You put it in a water bath, and then you cook it at a very even temperature. There's a circulator that goes in the water that makes the water exactly stay at the same temperature all the time. So the idea is you're breaking down the protein, the cartilages, and all that. Let's say you're using short ribs, yeah, for example. Put them in a bag, put a little seasoning in there, maybe a little red wine to get the flavors onto the ribs. Little stock, you could do so many different things in there. Put a couple bay leaf. and then seal the bag, take the air out, seal the bag, and then put it in a water bath at a very even temperature, let's say 160 degrees or 180 degrees, and then cook it. You leave it in there for as long as it takes to break down the whole idea is to break down the meat to the point of, like, stop to cook. It's all broken down, but it's not cooking yet. Does that make any sense what I'm saying?
Well, it's cooking, but to 160 degrees.
It's cooking to the point where it's not... When you put something in a pan, it keeps on cooking, right? Mm-hmm. When you put it in a bag, it stays even at the temperature you break it down to, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm.
So, for example, an egg. You put an egg in a bag, and you cook it at 62 degrees. The egg stays poached. It looks like a poached egg, except it's not keep on. It doesn't keep on cooking when you keep it at 62 degrees even. It's at the breaking point of, like, just mm-hmm. perfect, if that makes any sense.
Just
so you
work,
can
yeah.
actually keep it in that water bath for hours, and it mm-hmm. stays exactly the same. So from that point on, with meat, it's a great idea if you have, for example, a brisket. You have a 3-pound brisket like I did the other day. You put it in a bag, and you put it in and you cook it into that circulator, and you leave it in there for until it breaks down.
3 days.
It could be 3 days,
yes. A lot of short ribs are recipes, are 72-hour short
Correct.
Ribs. Yeah.
So then you take it out of the bag, and then what you have to do at the end is give it a nice sear. Mm-hmm. So you have a nice crusty meat on the outside, and you have a nice tasty meat on the outside, and then the rest is tender as tender can be.
And it's still red in the middle, which is kind right. of funny for a short rib, say, you know.
Yeah, that. Totally. So do you guys use this technique in your restaurants
we
at all?
We don't use it in the restaurant, because in the restaurant situation, it's extremely complicated. You need an ASAP program, which is a...
Oh, right.
Hazardous...
Something from the health department requirement yeah. that... You know, you would need a full-time staff on to be keeping track of all the... Because you have to freeze the fish before you put it in a bag. You have to time everything, temperature, everything. So it's a constant control. So for bigger company, like when Tom talks about Northwest Airlines, we're talking about thousands of meals. Mm-hmm. That makes sense. For example, the airport in Paris. In 1979, I went to the airport in Paris and visited with a chef there who had... walking that were the size of freezer that were the size of this room here mm-hmm. and they had fish on plate ready to go cryovac and ready to go into sous vide. This is in 1979, so this is a very old process mm-hmm. but anyway, the bottom line is we don't use it in our restaurant because it's too high of a processing and it will require more employees to just take care of that.
You know, we're not even allowed to use the vacuum sealers that are sold at Costco.
Correct.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
no.
You have to have a HACCP plan.
Correct.
Hazardous. I don't remember what the acronym stands for.
No, it's.
You guys remember what the acronym stands
no,
for?
No, it's not hazardous. I think it's health. Something.
Yeah, it's.
I can't
HACCP.
Remember what it means.
It's like if you make salami, anything where you
Correct.
Create an oxygen-free environment, they're concerned about. So that's okay. Let's get this other quick question in here while we're here. Thank you, Guy. We didn't get your name, sir.
Tony.
Still Tony. Good morning. If I was going to make steak fajitas, first of all, what's your favorite cut of meat for that? Mm-hmm. And then do you cook the meat first and then cut it, or do you cut it and then cook it? What's your preferred way?
So if I was going to make them, I would use skirt steak or hanger steak, and I would cook it first. I would marinate it in kind of a Mexican spice blend of some sort. Give it a really hard sear, crusty up. And at the same time I'm doing that, I would have my cast iron pan on the stove. And I would have my peppers and my onions and all that kind of stuff griddling and caramelizing and being deliciousness. And then I would just slice my meat. Because I like it rare. I know a lot of fajitas are not served rare. But I would slice my meat rare and then just put it on top. So I get the best of both worlds. I get the caramelized vegetables, and I get my rare steak.
So almost like you would a London broil, then.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly.
But I would cook it. Personally, I would cook it first. It's going to be very hard to grill pieces of steak.
Well, it'll cook on the hot cast iron, but it won't come out rare generally.
Correct.
If you've pre-cut it.
Well, and you see a lot of grocery stores will have a pan of fajita meat, and
right.
it's the meat and the vegetables all mixed together.
Right.
But that's not the best way
well,
to
that's
it.
I just bought that at Shoreline Central because I had never tried it. Carne asada kind of meat, I guess,
yeah.
is what they would call
mm-hmm.
it. And it didn't work for me. I liked my own seasoning. That stuff had too much, like, dried garlic and dried onion powder and things like that. That I like a little fresher version of that.
And so also, cool. I'm a big fan of separating my cooking components and then combine them at the end to put them in a stew or whatever you're going to do. But I believe in cooking things separately because an onion doesn't take the same amount of time as my rare piece of London broil or whatever you're going to be doing. So mixing everything together beforehand is not necessarily the best thing.
All right, up next, we're going to talk about some desserts, taking a dip into desserts on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in a hat.
And even though Brittany Bartleben, our usual pastry chef consultant, isn't here from the Dahlia Bakery, we're going to take on some dessert. Because I know you pride yourself in being a little bit of a dessert chef.
Yeah, I never was, I like making desserts, yes. I'm definitely not afraid to make desserts.
Yeah, I'm not either, but it was never one of those things I did a ton of. Do I need help? Oh, we have a baker.
Oh, somebody in the audience.
We have a baker. Come on up here and get on this mic. Come over here.
We're going to quiz you out.
Come on up here. We've got somebody from France Chocolates here who probably knows her way around the pastry kitchen. I'll say probably. We're going to find out.
Well, little do you guys know, I've worked for both of you.
Oh, you're right. I wouldn't have recognized you.
Sit close to the mic. What do you say? Little do we know what?
She worked for both of us, she said.
No.
In a way. Pastry, though, for... I've been here since 06.
Wow.
Yeah.
When did you leave the pastry department?
2 years ago.
Okay.
When Franz decided to snap me up.
Nice. Yeah. Well, congratulations.
Yeah,
nice
congratulations.
To see you. I wouldn't have recognized you.
It's the glasses.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. All right. So what's your name?
Jenna.
Jenna. Okay. Thanks, Jenna. We've got some questions that have been called in to our Facebook page.
Sure.
And so we're going to ask these out loud, and we're going to let you be the expert, and we're going to chime in. This is from Kath Deedon, or Dayden. I've been cooking for a long time. I do some baking, but I don't consider myself a baker. I've baked excellent cakes, but I've never been able to master a homemade angel food cake. Ooh, that's a good one, because a lot of people have this issue. I have a proper pan that is only used for angel food cakes. I'm successful with boxed angel food cake mixes, but my homemade attempts have been disasters. What is the secret?
It's all about the eggs, usually.
Really? I wouldn't have gone there.
Yeah, whites, they really need to make sure they're clean, because especially if you're doing it from home, you're not using a pasteurized egg. So that's the boxes. They have a pasteurized egg white that's completely clean. So you typically...
So I'm just going to stop you there for 1 second, because I don't think anyone uses that at home, right? So
it's powdered eggs.
Oh, so that's powdered
eggs.
And is it available in the grocery store?
Oh, yeah. You can, like Sur La Table or any of the kitchen stores, it's called meringue powder. Usually by using that can help out. But with angel food cake, though, too, if there's any impurity or even just like folding it incorrectly, if you're doing it from scratch, it can be disaster. I've wasted many huge batches of angel
food cake. Is an excellent angel food cake baker. So stop me where I do this wrong. One is you have to butter and flour your pan so that it can climb up the side of the pan.
Absolutely.
Hugely important, right?
Absolutely. I thought then the secret of angel food cake was not to butter the pan so it actually rises, because if you butter the pan, it stays.
I think maybe you're right.
No, you're talking bundt cakes, yeah.
Yeah, I'm talking So which way is it?
No, I believe it's
angel food cake.
It's unfloured. You don't want it. You want it to climb.
Right, you want it to stick to the pan. Mm-hmm.
Correct. You don't want to butter your pan.
Because when you pull it out of the oven, you want it to cling. Because then you turn it upside down.
Right, okay. I had that absolutely wrong.
It's actually a very important point, and some cookbooks are written wrong because of that. They're written with
butter. I'm curious if that could just be the simple solution. Okay, so now it goes up the edge. You've got pure eggs that you've whipped, not over-whipped, right?
Yeah, make sure they're room temperature. You've let them age overnight, so separate your eggs the night before in a covered bowl.
And a pinch of salt when you start beating them up.
Or even a little bit of cream of tartar.
Yeah.
That adds a little bit of... at least some wiggle room when you're beating the eggs to make sure that they have a little bit more. Like if you're folding, you're not going to overfold it.
Because
that second, sometimes it's just one fold and then suddenly it's completely broken.
Yeah, right. And you want it to be soft enough so you can, like you said, mix it into your batter.
Absolutely, yeah.
And because if it's too stiff, it doesn't actually mix well.
One of the things I do, too, is that a lot of recipes don't do this. I take a little bit of the sugar that you're supposed to be folding it in, and I add that to the egg whites as I'm beating it.
Keeps it smooth.
Yeah, and it gives you, it makes it so that it's a little more elastic. So when you're folding in that flour-sugar mixture, you're not you're not you have more of a window of working with the product.
And it gives the egg white a little bit more weight.
Absolutely.
Which doesn't allow it to break.
And really do turn it upside down while it's cooling, right?
Correct.
And don't go in and out of your oven. Just let it be.
And let
don't
it touch be. It. Don't
turn on the Beatles and let it be.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Kath, try some of those things. If it still doesn't work, give us a call back. We'll try again. This is from K. Robin Egger. A simple all-occasion chocolate cake. Still thinking about that Betty Crocker / Duncan Hines cake mix boxes you posted last week. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if she'd be willing to share the recipe, but Jackie, my wife Jackie, and our daughter Loretta just took a cake decorating and baking class at Honeycrumb Bakery over there on Elliott.
Oh, yeah.
And the cake that they brought home, the chocolate cake, was like my grandma used to make. It was from scratch, though, but it was perfect like grandma used to make. So I would say if you call Honeycrumb and see if she's willing to share that recipe, that's perfect chocolate cake. Is there another trick that you like?
One of the things I like to do, actually, is instead of using water in the base, I use coffee. Because it makes it so much richer, and it brings out. Because I mean, unless you're buying really expensive cocoa, you're not putting in melted chocolate. So the cocoa powder and the coffee, they make it taste richer. Also, using oil-based chocolate cakes, that really for me, I found that with chocolate cakes specifically, if it's an oil and egg base with a little bit of coffee, that oil is what brings all that moisture out.
It also keeps it moist.
Right.
It actually takes it out, but keeps it at the same time, so it's moist enough. Yeah.
Yeah. My grandmother, she used oils-based cakes, so for me, that's nostalgia completely. Mm-hmm. But
And that's often in cake box mixes, right? It says add an egg and a cup of vegetable oil or something like that.
Really, you can't mess with that.
Yeah, exactly.
There is a frosting, though, that's like Betty Crocker and Duncan Hines had a baby. It's Martha Stewart's chocolate sour cream recipe. I found that like 20 or 15 years ago. Uh-huh. And I cannot get away from it.
Cool.
Good.
That's a good tip.
Not to plug her. I'm sorry.
No, I have no problem. Martha's cool. So is Snoop. Mark Leland asks, simple, fresh dessert ideas. Both seem to be my nemesis as a home cook. Wow, that's kind of shocking.
I'm a big
fresh,
fan.
Fresh pastry? Is that what she's asking?
No,
Simple, fresh dessert ideas.
So like probably a fresh fruit tart.
Yeah.
Or with a little pastry cream on the bottom.
Yeah,
you know,
I was
going to
say custard immediately.
Very classic. Also, I'm a big fan
of... Go to France and buy chocolates?
Exactly. Go to France and buy some chocolates. But I'm a big fan of pavlova.
Yeah.
Which is so simple to... It's not hard to make pavlova.
Mm-mm.
Just it's all about the egg white, the meringue construction of
Or making
the
like
sugar
a curd. Curd for that pavlova.
And then you make a passion fruit curd or you make something citrusy curd. Mm-hmm. Put that inside your pavlova. And then throw in strawberries, cherries, whatever you want.
Yeah.
Fruit, it pretty much goes with just about anything.
Especially here in Washington, there's so many fresh fruits.
Yeah.
You could honestly just put cream on anything.
Yeah, exactly. Whipped cream and pavlova and passion fruit curd.
Maybe some pound cake. There you go.
You can't go wrong.
We just brought the first strawberries from our farm, Prosser Farm, over to the restaurants. Excited about that. We'll probably have another, starting a month of strawberries and local berries, which would be awesome.
We just picked our first two strawberries from the window boxes at Luke. My mom made both of them. I was like, what?
Well, Jenna, thank you. Jenna from France Chocolates
jumped
out of the audience and became
thank
our
you.
Dessert expert. Jenna, we're going to give you a $100 gift card to the Hot Stove Society for jumping in and being our dessert specialist. You can just come to the radio show 5 more times with that card. All right. Up next... Kitchen Gadgets and Maintenance, right here on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio. We're having fun here today. We've still got two segments to go. Stay with us for the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. For the first time in our show's history, we're going to have a guest come up and challenge us, and remember that the guest has to pony up something if they lose. So I'm very curious what she owns that she wants to give away.
That's cool.
We are having our 20th anniversary down at the Rub Shack down in the Pike Place Market. It's 20 years since we started the Rub with Love line, and it's amazing. I
remember when you started
old.
This.
Yeah, I am freaky old.
Well, yes, you are. No worries.
But do you remember how I started it? Do you remember what was the inspiration? The whole Rum and Love line?
No.
I was asked to be a judge at the Jack Daniel's World Barbecue Invitational. And they flew me down to Lynchburg, Tennessee, which is a dry place, by the way, dry county, oddly enough.
Sad news.
I got my little packet of information, how to be a proper judge, and a half pint of Jack Daniel's, because you can't buy it anywhere there, so they have to give it to you. And then on the Friday night of the weekend judging, we went out and did the charcoal stroll. And I met a good friend of ours there for the first
time.
Nathan Mervold. He was in, I want to say, John Willoughby's barbecue RV from North Carolina. He's gone on to do modernist cuisine and intellectual ventures. He was early on at Microsoft, a bazillionaire.
And modernist bread.
Yeah, bread and beautiful books, art gallery. Anyway, getting back, what I loved most about my adventure being down at the Jack Daniels and where Rub With Love came from was that night before the action started, with the rubbing of the whole pigs. Anything that took a long time, they started that prior evening. And we did, there was 140 campsites around the field.
Wow.
Looked like the pictures you see of the Civil War tents.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And the smoke coming up from each of the smokers. And I was strolling around with my little half pint of Jack. And I just fell in love with the whole rub concept. And I was thinking that there was nothing like it in Seattle.
Right.
And we were getting ready to open Etta's. And I thought, one of the things that I was worried about Etta's was like, okay, we're going to be a seafood house, and I want our salmon to be delicious, but there's a lot of other salmon dishes. I want some magazine or newspaper, somebody to say this is the best salmon dish in Seattle. And so I came up, and I made a rub for the salmon. I cold smoked it, and then when you ordered it in the kitchen, in the dining room, I would then sear it, and I served it with my cornbread pudding and shiitake mushrooms and blah, 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 blah. Everyone loved it. It became an instant hit for us. Seattle Magazine came out and said within a few months that it was the best salmon dish in Seattle. So I achieved my goal. I think it was Seattle Magazine. Who knows? That's 25 years ago. Oh, my God. So then we thought everyone wanted the recipe. So that's I said, well, I can't give away the recipe. It's too simple. You know, it took time because of the smoking process, but it was pretty simple. So I said, let's just try putting it in bags and see if we can sell it. So we put them at the host stand, and I made a pork rub to go with it and a steak rub because I didn't think you could sell just one thing.
Right.
I think I was wrong on that. But now we have 15 rubs. But they sold like crazy that summer. I sold 3,000 bags that summer off the host stand at Etta's. And it became a product line for us. We just kind of went for it, and now we sell millions of dollars a year of spice rubs. And we have a warehouse in Ballard where we manufacture it, and it's become this really cool thing. So about 5 years ago, we started the Rub Shack down in the north end of the market area.
Mm-hmm.
We're not actually literally in the market, so we could do that, right?
Right next to Etta's.
Yeah, right next to Etta's and in between Seatown Market Diner.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're having an anniversary party, our 20th anniversary party at the Rub Shack. It's 11 to 3 on Friday, June 14th, right before Father's Day weekend. And, you know, as tradition would have it, in our restaurants, if you book a Father's Day reservation, breakfast, lunch, or dinner at any of our restaurants and say so when you're there, you get to pick of any one of our rubs or sauces. So we're going to continue that at the Rub Shack. If you buy a sandwich or anything there, you can pick a free rub to go with it. We have 15 different flavors. They're about, you know, anywhere from $6 to $10 in value, depending on who's selling it where. And so it'll be your choice to come down. And we have beautiful wild salmon burgers and all sorts of things. It's going to be
an
exciting
afternoon.
So you're
going to get all the dads, and I'm going to get none of them.
I'm flying in from Copenhagen, trying to get here in time to be at this event. So we will see if that happens or not. But the location is the Rub With Love Shack. It's the north end of the Pike Place Market, right next to Etta's and Seatown. And it's going to be party like it's 1999. That's the year we started this craziness. Salmon burgers, music, prize wheel, and a free rub if you know the Seattle Kitchen secret handshake.
Oh. Please do show.
Or password.
Please do show these people what that looks like.
So you have to shake a bit, right? Because it's rubbing. You have to go, woohoo, I love Rub With Love.
If you do that handshake, you might get arrested too.
Do that with us. Woohoo, I love Rob with love. All right, good practice.
All right.
If you do that, you'll get a free rub at the Rub Shack on June 14th from 11 to 3.
You're going to have a bunch of people on top of Pike Place Market going, woo-hoo-hoo!
Yeah. We'll see. If you do that in the wrong store, if it's not the Rub Shack, you might get arrested. Okay. Kitchen gadgets.
Kitchen gadgets.
What are some fun, non-necessity kitchen gadgets that you own, Chef? Well, non-necessity, right? Because people have small kitchens.
I have a sous vide machine and a circulator. I think it's definitely not a must, but it's fun to have. And it's fun to play with. You know, we were talking about sous vide earlier. You know, it's nice to put a nice piece of meat in, or a piece of fish for that matter, into. But I don't do actually sous vide fish. I do meat only. And put it in there and use it. And it's on my iPhone, and I can just use the app to just stop it and go, okay, it's ready. Take it out of the water and use it tomorrow. So it's very fun. That's definitely not a useful tool. Actually, it's a useful tool, but it's not a necessity.
Right. I would say mine is the melon baller. I love using it. I try to figure out ways to use it, but it's work to figure it out. Like, I like to core pears and apples with it and things like that, but it's certainly not a necessity. And it seems like every kitchen's got a vintage melon baller in it. Nobody buys a new one.
It's nice to make chocolate truffles.
Oh.
You know, if you make a chocolate ganache,
that's an ice cream scoop, though.
If you make those are big truffles.
Oh, the little tiny ice cream scoop. It's hard to get them out of those.
I know what he's talking about. I'm just trying to. Most people have an ice cream scoop the size of my hands. So.
I know, but see, if you use the melon baller, then you have to dip it in hot water, and then you got water in your chocolate. It's just a bad idea.
You're not trying to make France chocolate. We're not competing here.
Yes, we are. What are the essential tools that every home cook should have? So just the opposite. What do you feel like? And let's take knives and spatulas out of the mix. But a tool that you find super handy
in
the kitchen.
I cannot usually cook. When I do get in the kitchen, whether it's at Luke or Lule or whatever, I usually prep my station. It's something that I do as a chef. I don't start working until I have my apron on. I put a cutting board on the table, which is very important, and I usually put a knife, the knife I'm going to need, a big chef knife and a smaller knife for different jobs, and a fish spatula. What I call a fish spatula is, I don't know if you have one on hand, Tom, could show the audience, but it's this kind of triangle lined metal spatula. You know, they make them in plastic or whatever. This is probably one of my favorite tools in the kitchen because it allows you to be, whether the piece is fairly big in your pans or smaller, it's a very useful tool to turn things around, upside down, or whatever you do. I really love that tool. It's one tool that I've used for many, many years. And I also think a pair of tongs is a must in the kitchen. I know you have a smaller pair of tongs for shorter jobs, but also a long pair of tongs so you don't burn yourself. But, you know, it's very nice. It's kind of like using chopstick is very... you know, something you have to learn not to use. But the pair of tongs is very useful for many different things, and it allows you to do things without burning yourself and panicking and dropping things on the ground and so on and so forth. So,
I think it's interesting, you know, when you talk about tongs, that when I was a cook, tongs were everything, right?
I didn't have tongs when I was a cook.
When I was a cook, tongs were the bomb.
Yeah.
Now all these youngsters, I shouldn't say youngsters, cause a lot of old cooks do it too, but they've moved to tweezers.
Yeah, I know.
Because they're being more specific in their placement, I guess.
Right.
And I just find it, my hands are too fat. My hands are just too big for a pair of
tongs.
They make bigger ones too, I know, but.
You're used to the bulk stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So that's an interesting tool that I think a lot of home kitchens don't have.
Yeah, and I think it's very, you know, those are not expensive tools to buy, but I think they're very useful.
When it comes to a power kitchen tool that's essential, I don't think the Cuisinart is as essential, right? I don't know. I love having the blender for frozen drinks.
I think the blender, to me, the Vitamix blender, I use Vitamix because it's a powerful tool. Than I use and, you know, whatever. I think it's probably one of the tools I use the most, the power of tool I use the most in the kitchen. I use it for blending. I use it for crushing. I have a small bullet that I use for small chopping. You know, if you buy the kit of the bullet, it's like $35, and I grind my coffee every day in one of the cups. I use it for coffee grinding. It's excellent. And the other cup I use for, like, you know, fine chopping of herbs or whatever I want to do quickly. If I'm doing a bunch of herbs or making a pesto or whatever, I just use that, and it's very useful.
All right, up next, it's time for Food for Thought, Tasty Trivia on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Rotero, the chef in a hat.
And we have decided to invite an audience member up to challenge us in our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge.
First time ever.
First time ever. And so what we did was we took everyone in the audience that wanted to try and kick our butts to put their name into a bowl. And then I picked out a name. And we have invited Renee Swanson down to the microphone. Hey! Renee, what brought you to the Seattle Kitchen Show today? Oh. I mean, not literally, but...
Not my car.
Not your car.
I love coming down here, and I have Wednesdays off, and you guys usually record on Tuesdays.
That's true.
So I saw Wednesday, so I jumped on it.
Yeah.
Good for
friend.
You. You're paying attention. I like it.
Yeah.
Okay, Renee, so today we're going to play for Kath Dayton, or Dayton, as the audience likes to say. She had the question about the angel food cakes, which Jenna, our audience member, so helpfully answered. Hopefully that works for her. And if it doesn't, she'll win a prize as a consolation from one of us losers. Because there can only be two winners, and there has to be a loser.
Correct.
Right?
For sure there is one loser.
Okay, Chef. What are you going to give away if you lose today, Chef?
I'm going to give Kate brunch for two at Luc on a Saturday or a Sunday.
Wow. What kind of value is that? $25?
Priceless.
Priceless. Well, I am going to give Kath, if I lose, I am going to give her a $100 gift card to the Seatown Market Diner.
Ooh, so and if she knows right there, if she knows the handshake, and if she knows, oh my God, she could be scoring big that day.
Yeah, I guess she could. Now, I told you, Renee, before you started that, you had to have something of value, something that's important, personal to you, that you would be really concerned about having to give away if you were to happen to lose today. So,
well, I was very lucky and ended up with this most valuable kitchen tool in my hand right before I came up here.
So you're giving away a fish bat.
And a pair of long tongs.
Oh, wow, good for you.
Nice. Some handy kitchen tools.
Yes.
Yeah, it's very valuable.
All right. Excellent. Absolutely.
Good job.
Good for you. That's very cool. I like that.
It's my fish bat.
Yes, I know.
Okay.
I know she's giving your fish spatula away.
But all right, let's get this show on the road.
I think the idea is cool.
We only have a few minutes for this now.
That's right. So as you might know, this is how it runs. Renee, are you familiar with this segment of the show?
Yes.
Okay, great. Well, I'm still going to explain it for other people that may not be. So I've got five questions for each of you. And, you know, if you get all of the questions wrong, you're the loser. And you have to give something away, which we've already discussed. If you get everything right, you're the winner. And you can sit safely here and not give anything away. So who wants to go first? Terry,
that's
you usually go first.
Yeah, that's
all right. Terry, what is the culinary term for the white head of a cauliflower?
Floret.
The curd.
Hmm. Oh, that's English. Sorry. Floret was French.
Okay. Are we taking that? We're not taking that.
I'm just kidding.
You can't confuse me with your logic.
Okay, I was trying to. I'm playing a Tom here. I'm learning from the master.
All right. Approximately what percentage of calories do American adults get from refined sugar? 5%, 20%, or 40%?
Jesus. 20.
You got it. That's 20 right. is right.
It can't be 40 because they would be dead. I mean... Or they would be running around until they run out of gas.
All right, are you ready for number three?
Sure.
All right. What are the three ingredients in a fluffernutter? Also a fun word to say. Hmm. Fluffernutter.
What are the three ingredients?
Uh-huh.
Is it a food dish?
Yes.
I'm just making sure we're in the right place here. I'm going to go egg white.
Nope.
Okay. Well, that's a bad
stuff. Peanut butter, flour, and sugar.
I'm going to go...
Close.
Well, there's definitely sugar for sure. I was going to say sugar somewhere along the line.
All right, give me three.
Okay, sugar, flour, and nuts.
Bread, peanut butter, and marshmallow fluff.
Oh, I was thinking of the cookie, the little peanut cookie.
The nutter butter.
Nutter butter, yeah. That's what I was thinking.
All right, Terry.
It's margarine if it's nutter butter.
What brunch staple was born when Mr. and Mrs. LeGrand Benedict complained that there was nothing new on the menu of Manhattan's Delmonico's restaurant?
Look at the audience. They're all going, oh, we know this. How about the eggs, Benedict?
You
maybe?
Got it. Huh? Nice job. All right, that's two. Here's
that was
one
hard
more.
To get the answer here.
How many teaspoons are in a tablespoon?
Three.
You got it. All right, that's three.
I love that Sean had to look it up to see if that was correct.
Of course. I'm going to check his work. That's.
Well, I just went three.
Yeah, that's three out of five. Not too bad.
Chef, ooh, chef.
Right on the edge.
Tom
right
or Renee?
Renee, do you want to go next?
Sure.
Okay.
All right,
okay,
as the saying goes, ladies second. Pepitas are the seeds of what fall fruit?
Pumpkin.
You got it.
Nice.
Good job, Renee.
Wow. Oh, we're in trouble.
Yep. All right, Renee. After shrimp, what is the most popular seafood in the United States?
Mm. Lobster?
Tuna.
Tuna.
All right, Renee. Not too bad. Which stage of candy making occurs at a higher temperature? Hardball stage or hard crack stage?
Hard crack.
Yes.
Yes. Good job. All right. Wow,
two for three.
Dang.
Can we have someone else come up, please? This is no fun.
Yeah, Renee, you're just ruining this for everybody. Which fish is highest in beneficial omega-3 fatty acids? Trout, eel, or salmon?
Salmon.
Trout.
Ooh.
Wow.
I would never have guessed that.
Wow.
Shocker.
Shocker.
Shocker. Here on the
you were doing so good. Now you're two for two.
Don't listen to the audience. Okay, one more for you. What is the term for the prepared innards and extremities of animals?
I would say it's awful good.
Mm.
Oh, awful.
You got it.
Yay!
The payoff was fantastic.
Exactly.
Wow, so far you and Terry are tied with three correct.
All right. Okay.
All right.
So now if Tom gets anything below three, he's the loser. And if he gets four or five.
We're going to have to do a showdown between you and I.
That's right. It'll be a tie.
Okay.
All right, Tom, what is raw milk?
An unpasteurized milk.
Correct. Number two, what herb is the leaves and stems of the coriander plant?
What herb? You're talking about cilantro?
I am, Tom. Okay. Yes. What is the more common term for bovine spongiform
mad cow disease.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Wow, that's already three correct.
Yeah. Challenges.
All right, Tom. What is the main botanical ingredient that gives gin its flavor?
Juniper berries.
Boom.
Yes.
Boom.
You've already won it, but let's just show these two how it's
okay.
done. What are carrageen, kombu, and agar?
Seaweed.
Yep. Boom.
Yay!
5 out of 5.
Woo! Tom is back.
First time in a while.
All right. So, Tom.
All right. We have a slap off.
That's right.
Renee, so. You and Terry, the first person
put
to
your
slap.
Hand close to the counter there.
And okay. As soon as you know the answer, you slap.
Okay.
But if you slap, you have to give the answer.
Okay.
That's right. True or false, garlic breath can still be present 18 hours after garlic is ingested.
Renee.
Terry.
Yes.
Renee, Terry, you got it.
True.
Renee.
Oh, Renee.
True? True.
Yes.
You win.
Yeah.
Yay.
Way to go.
Yeah.
All right.
That means Kath won brunch for two at Luke Restaurant.
That is correct.
Congratulations.
You get to keep your spatula.
I get to keep my spatula. Thank you,
Tom.
Renee, for being a good sport.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Renee, do you have any of my books?
No.
Thanks for nothing. I'm going to get you a signed book for
but
being
you have
a
mine,
fun
right?
participant.
You have mine, right?
If you want to be part of our show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. This show is produced by Large Media. That's LARJ Media. And our sound engineer and today's quizmaster, Sean, don't call me Del Torre. If you want to be part of our studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $20. Remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.